Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm, sitting in for Radio Free Market founder, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is the war on drugs. Is it a war on Americans? Reevaluating the insanity of prohibition. We are lucky to have as our guest today, Dr. Mark Thornton. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be with you here today, Drew, on Radio Free Market.
Thank you. Dr. Thornton is a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He wrote The Economics of Prohibition, detailing the history of prohibition, the flawed motivations behind such policies, and their horrendous effects. Dr. Thornton, I wanted to start the show with a little bit of history about prohibition. Was prohibition always a policy goal of government?
Well, you know, prohibition is a general policy, but we think of it in the United States in terms of alcohol prohibition, because that was the biggest prohibition, especially during the 1920s, but it's also something that dates back to the colonial era in the United States. So in the colonial era, they had prohibitions on alcohol. They later had prohibitions on selling alcohol to the Indians. They had local prohibitions on alcohol and state prohibitions on alcohol long before we got to the point after World War I. They had passed the income tax, and then they went ahead and passed the Prohibition Amendment, the 18th Amendment, to the U.S. Constitution, which set up a nationwide ban on the production, distribution, and consumption of alcohol. And, of course, that was a total disaster, and it was eventually repealed in 1933 with the 21st Amendment to the Constitution. But, of course, we still have many, many other prohibitions today, most notably, of course, with narcotics and marijuana. But, you know, we can think of prohibition as affecting other industries in the country, such as prostitution, gambling, insider stock trading, and a variety of other things. The whole edifice of government regulation is really one prohibition after another.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the income tax. I mean, it was actually during the progressive era that the national prohibition on alcohol was passed. It was also, of course, during the progressive era that the national income tax was enacted, the Federal Reserve was established, and a slew of other regulations to stifle competition were passed. It seems like the progressives were naturally inclined to support prohibition.
Oh, absolutely. And progressive means simply that you're progressing towards socialism. And the progressives wanted much greater government control over our lives, and the opportunity of World War I coming about, created this opportunity to enact a slew of constitutional amendments and legislative acts which vastly increased the size of government. So the government in the United States vastly increased during World War I, but it never, never, ever shrunk back to its pre-World War I level because the progressives got it built into the government itself, built into our Constitution. And the prohibitionists and the progressives supported the income tax because it would give more money to the government, but also they knew that they needed that alternative source of revenue in order to repeal prohibition on alcohol, because alcohol taxes were 20% of all federal revenues, and it was an important source of revenue for state governments, county governments, and local governments. And so prohibition would have never happened if they hadn't had the income tax as an alternative source of generating revenue.
We're kind of starting to see how different groups get together to try to figure out best ways to make policies that affect and hurt other Americans. And this is really starting to delve into bootleggers and Baptists. And while we won't have time before the break to fully develop this concept, I really thought it was important to bring out right now, because given in the progressive era.
That's right. You don't really understand why we have prohibition unless you understand the political model of Baptist and bootleggers and how they form an economic coalition to bring it about.
We're coming up on our first break here on Radio Free Market, and after the break, we will continue our discussion with Dr. Mark Thornton on how the war on drugs is really a war on Americans. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host for the day, Drew Yelm, and I'm talking with Dr. Mark Thornton on the war on drugs. Is it really a war on Americans? Before the break, we started talking about the history of Prohibition along with the bootleggers and Baptists. This is a topic previously addressed by Dr. Thornton on Radio Free Market with Michael McKay and special commentator Christopher Opperman. This comes up again today because it is so integral in the study of Prohibition. Mark, what exactly is meant by bootleggers and Baptists?
Well, in order to understand why we have Prohibition, you have to set aside the moral arguments and the ethical arguments surrounding all of these issues of drugs and alcohol. And you have to get behind and look at the economic impact and who benefits, where you have to follow the money. And in this case, with alcohol prohibition, we find a very ironic coalition from Baptists and bootleggers. The Baptists, of course, naturally want alcohol to be prohibited because of religious reasons. And so they end up supporting the effort with donations and votes and things of that nature. Bootleggers also benefit from prohibition. They make a lot of money off of prohibition of alcohol, and so they support the enactment of prohibition and the continuation and expansion of prohibition because it's good for their business. And so therefore you have two groups, the Baptists and the bootleggers, who are kind of like polar opposites in terms of their view of things, and yet they coalesce on this issue both in support of prohibition. We also see in other issues, for example, environmentalists and big oil companies getting together to prohibit new drilling of oil. The environmentalists don't want the oil being drilled, and the established oil companies also don't want new drillers out there because they've got their oil and they don't want new competitors coming into the market.
In the economics of prohibition, you discuss that there are many groups that try to use the government for the benefit, and in particular for prohibition, you list the American Medical Association and the American Pharmaceutical Association as two major players in the prohibition movement. What exactly was their goal in trying to enact prohibition?
Well, they want control, and they got it, basically. They both got monopolies over the distribution of drugs and the monopolies over selling medical advice and medical procedure services to people. They didn't want people having alternatives. And back in the 19th century, you got to remember, things like opium and morphine were actually very effective drugs. People were living out, tens of miles away from the nearest doctor or the nearest pharmacy. But if you had a bottle of morphine, for example, then major medical problems you could deal with on your own. You wouldn't have to drive all the way into town in order to get those services. You could, in fact, you could alleviate the pain in order to get into town. So doctors and pharmaceutical companies wanted that freedom to be taken away so that everybody would have to go to the medical doctors and then take the established specific remedies offered up by the pharmaceutical company. So again, it's a matter of control, it's a matter of economics, it's a matter of establishing a monopoly and preventing outside competition, because all of the things that are prohibited, cocaine, marijuana, narcotics, opium, these are all medical, these all have very important medical uses, and so they're a threat to the established drug companies with their patents and the medical, American Medical Association and their monopoly over medical services.
And later on after alcohol prohibition, starting with marijuana prohibition, there were large corporate opponents to legalized drugs, such as William Randolph Hearst, the famed publisher, and the DuPont Corporation. What exactly were their goals in enacting prohibition?
Well, that's another good example. For example, on marijuana prohibition, marijuana has a large variety of industrial and commercial uses. It produces oil, an oil-based product, which would compete with some of the DuPont products. It can be used for textiles, and the DuPont company had recently established a patent on the production of synthetic textile materials, rayon, nylon, things of that nature. And hemp, which all early Americans basically made their clothing out of hemp, was a competitor because hemp is a low-cost, substitute. It's something that is long lasting. It was used to make rope and sails, writing materials, as well as the ink to use to write on the paper. So by eliminating hemp and marijuana from the marketplace, it essentially gave the patents that the companies had much more effectiveness, because it eliminated one of the most important competitors for their products.
In addition to these private interests trying to enact prohibitions for their own goals, you also mentioned that bureaucracies promoted and extended the policy of prohibition. For what purpose would government itself seek prohibition?
Well, I mean, it's bigger and bigger government. I mean, look at the war on drugs right now and the vast bureaucracy that is involved, all the way from the coast with the Coast Guard, right into your hometown with the police getting drug money and property confiscation, forfeiture money. It helps to expand the bureaucracy. It helps to expand the power of the government and control over everybody's lives. So, you know, bureaucracies have these natural tendencies to expand, to get, more authority, bigger budgets, more powerful guns on their part. And so in two important cases, with the Harrison Narcotics Act and the Marijuana Tax Act, those were both passed by Congress as a simple tax measure whereby government wanted to tax narcotics and then later tax marijuana, but the bureaucracies themselves took it on their own initiative to basically declare effective prohibitions over these products. They didn't want to be in the business simply of collecting taxes and issuing receipts. They wanted to be in the business of enforcing a prohibition.
Even with the Marijuana Tax Stamp Act, they require that people buy these stamps, but the problem was they would actually never issue the stamps, and it would be kind of hard for people to get them.
Yeah, and they've tried that, of course, even in more recent years at the state level. Alabama did the same thing. They required everybody who sold marijuana, which, of course, is illegal, to have stamps. No one in their right mind would go to the state government and buy these stamps to identify themselves as marijuana dealers. And yet, if they caught you with marijuana and you hadn't paid the tax, they could arrest you for marijuana prohibition and arrest you for violating the tax code. So it's just another way of adding on bigger penalties and bringing in larger amounts of money into those bureaucracies.
So among all these various groups of so-called bootleggers and Baptists, it's hard to find among them any single noble motivation. They always want to use the state to limit personal economic liberty of free people. But I guess, one of the arguments that they make is that it makes people healthier. But this is questionable, too. What happens to the potency of various substances during prohibition?
Well, I mean, one of my big findings that I published in The Economics of Prohibition is that enacting prohibitions makes whatever is prohibited more potent. In order to conceal it from the cops, the dealers make it more potent and therefore more dangerous and more addictive. So, whenever they say we're enacting this prohibition to save the children or whatever, what they're actually doing is putting out on the street much more dangerous, much more potent drugs. And every time we see a crackdown on the part of the federal government raising penalties, sentences, increasing enforcement, what the market does is switch. You know, they try to make it more and more potent, but when they get to a certain point, what they have to do is jump to an even more dangerous drug, even a more potent drug. And so what we've seen lately here in the United States is that as enforcement has been cracked down since 9/11 and things are much more difficult to move around the country illicitly, we've seen that a lot of rural Americans have turned from the traditional illegal drugs to crystal meth, which is even more damaging, very potent, highly addictive. So they haven't actually improved anybody's health. I mean, the number of overdoses in the United States has climbed dramatically in recent years because of prohibitions. We've seen illegal drugs result in more and more overdoses, and we've also seen legal drugs entering the black market to fill a void, such as OxyContin, And as a result, the number of overdoses has dramatically increased. And a lot of this has to do with prohibition and limited information about these drugs.
Well,
I mean, if a regular legal dealer would tell anybody that if you take these drugs in sufficient quantities and you drink alcohol in sufficient quantities, you can kill yourself with these things, where normally most of these things, if they were sold legally, would not be that harmful.
We're coming up on a break here real quick, but the question that begs to be answered is, you know, before drug prohibition, were these drugs actually dangerous? Was the nation just full of junkies?
No, I mean, there were a lot of addicts from the Civil War on. Anytime there was a war, people would get the addiction rate would go up. But people weren't dying. People weren't dropping dead. People weren't overdosing on these drugs. They were commercially produced. So, heroin pills were produced by Bayer Pharmaceutical and prescribed to little children. So taken under the right conditions and consumed under the right conditions and produced under the right conditions, we did not see, you know, the people dying across the country like we do today.
And going back to methamphetamine, it's just so amazing and ridiculous that people would go to use such a terrible substance given all these other alternatives. I mean, it's such a dangerous thing. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and, you know, prohibition creates these dangerous forms of the drugs. They lead us to even more dangerous types of drugs, and they also create the condition where there's just not a lot of information available, whereas normal commercial interest, if they're selling a dangerous product.
We're coming up on break here real quick. This is Drew Yelm and Radio Free Market. After the break, we'll continue to talk with Mark Thornton about the economics of prohibition. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm, and we're talking with Dr. Mark Thornton about the economics of prohibition. Before the break, we were talking about how people could use such dangerous drugs like methamphetamine given other alternatives, and this is precisely because of prohibition. You wanted to finish your thought, Dr. Thornton?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention to people that when a product is produced not in the black market or the underground economy, but in a commercial form above ground, that the commercial company who's producing and selling and distributing products that have dangers associated with them, and let's face it, these drugs have dangers associated with them, but they have to tell their customers, notify the customer about these dangers, or they face a big liability. And so there's all sorts of ways in which the market economy protects consumers against the worst ravages of dangerous products, whether it's drugs or automobiles or ladders to get up on your roof, commercial interest, try to help the consumer as much as possible and keep them safe.
Well, and I'm sure that, you know, with prohibition, only the most highly qualified producers of these substances enter the market, and that makes them, is that correct?
Yeah, a vast majority of total production and distribution would be handled by the people who went out in the marketplace. And so you're going to have, safety-conscious companies that are going to be producing these products that are used to dangerous situations, like drug companies. You know, they're very, if you look at, you know, your prescriptions, they've got all sorts of warnings about side effects and so forth. We would expect basically the same thing to happen in the market for dangerous drugs. And by the way, I'd like to let listeners know that you can get a free electronic copy of my book, The Economics of Prohibition, on our website, Mises.org. That's Mises.org.
One of the most apparent social costs caused imposed by prohibition is the large increase in crime associated with trafficking. You know, I remember learning in school that Al Capone and other gangsters in the 1920s made their money off of bootlegging, and they had murderous reigns in the cities. But these days, the connection between the current drug war and heightened crime seems to be downplayed. I've always wondered why it is that drug gangs will have shooting wars to claim particular corner to sell drugs, but like Walmart or Target won't have a street fight to corner the market on toilet paper. What exactly is the difference?
Oh, well, I mean, you described it beautifully, that in illegal markets there is no law, there is no property rights, and so as a result you get things like organized crime and street gangs as an organized way of enforcing their will upon their competitors. And so it's naturally going to result in more violence, more murder, more violent crime. And it's not surprising that the murder rate in the United States went from 5 per 100,000 population before prohibition to over 10 per 100,000 population during prohibition, and then quickly fell back to 5 after prohibition. And it's not just that the murder rate fell, but those increased murders during prohibition, most of them were never solved, whereas the bottom 5 are typically solved. And so as a consequence, you not only get more crime, but you get more unsolved crime. And as a result, the whole violent and criminal environmental conditions are drastically increased. And, you know, we see it in the United States where whole inner cities have been basically eaten out by the drug war as crime and corruption fester in those local government conditions. And as a result, just break down everything within society. And if you've got the courage, you ought to go take a look at some of the cities like Detroit, inner St. Louis, parts of Los Angeles, parts of New York that have basically been effectively destroyed by the war on drugs.
Well, people in those cities will break into houses and steal the plumbing out of the walls to get enough money to get back into their fix or their habit. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, the whole fabric of society, when it's so close-knit like that, and then you introduce the war on drugs, you introduce street gangs, you introduce murders and crime, you know, and you can just look at it. The end result is in the U.S. prison system, where we have over 2 million citizens in prison. More than half of them are the result of nonviolent drug offenses. We have the highest incarceration rate of any country in the world. And, you know, that's the end result of it. And, you know, putting people in jail was supposed to stop the problem, but of course it hasn't. The more people we put in prison, it seems like just the more crime we have out on the streets, and it's basically all tagged, or a very large percentage of it is tagged to the war on drugs, which has gotten the attention, the complete attention of the police and the courts and the prisons. And so nobody's really paying enough attention to property crimes. And as a result, property crimes also increase. So it's just a terrible mess. And what happened during when FDR got elected was he cleaned up the whole problem by repealing prohibition.
And that's a very important point to bring up. You wrote in a recent Mises.org daily article, The Real Reason for FDR's Popularity, about this subject. But wasn't FDR popular because he brought all the jobs back with the New Deal? Why exactly was FDR so popular?
No, I mean, every historian will tell you, well, it was the New Deal and it was World War II. But the New Deal never actually solved the Depression. The unemployment rate was over 15% during FDR's terms during the 1930s. What really did make a difference for FDR was that he went into office, he immediately called for repeal, he passed legalization of beer, he got the constitutional amendment started, and basically organized crime disappeared, political corruption disappeared.
Mark, we're coming up to a break here on Radio Free Market. Please stay tuned. After the break, we will continue to talk with Dr. Mark Thornton about the economics of prohibition. Please stand by. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm, and I'm talking with Dr. Mark Thornton about the economics of prohibition. Before the break, we started to talk about the real reason for FDR's popularity and FDR to legalize beer. Is that correct?
That's correct. The first week in office, he dealt with the budget crisis and he dealt with the banking crisis. And then the first item on his agenda was getting the repeal prohibition started and legalizing beer.
Wasn't there more of a fiscal reason for them having to legalize beer and other alcohol at this point in time?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was the big problem, and repeal probably wouldn't have happened as quickly, but of course, the nation was running deficits at the federal, state, and local level. School budgets were being cut, firemen were being let off of work, and the government needed money, and alcohol prior to prohibition was a major source of revenue for the government, 20% for the federal government and substantial parts of the budgets of state, county, and local governments. And so with income tax revenues falling during the Depression, they needed to fill the gap, and they did it with alcohol taxes.
getting back to what we were talking about earlier with the role of the police in society, another major problem with prohibition is the expansion of the police state. They spend so much time looking for vices that property crimes are overlooked. Now, while ostensibly there to make people safer, with more drug laws in the books, the more dangerous society has become. So just how big is the police state in the United States as a result of the drug war?
Well, it's huge. We have a tremendous amount of law enforcement services. At the local level, of course, police budgets have ballooned by property forfeiture laws, whereby anybody who's involved with drugs, they may see their house or their car or their boat possessed by the government and sold for cash that goes into the police budgets. But it goes all the way up to the top, including the spy surveillance state, which of course also gets a role within the drug war. And as a consequence, we have the local, the county, the state police, the federal police, and then all of the multitude of spy organizations, and of course the U.S. military is even involved with the war on drugs, and it's a big moneymaker. Hillary Clinton the other day said, was asked, why can't we legalize drugs and get the problems of violence along the U.S.-Mexican border dealt with? And she said, well, it was because there's too much money involved in the war on drugs. And she really misspoke on that, but she spoke the truth, basically, is that there's too much money being made off of this. It's too much a factor in the budgets of all of these police and enforcement organs of our government. And as a consequence, all of these interests within government as well as outside of government want to see the war on drugs not only maintained, but they want to see it expanded. And they know of the problems, for example, along the Mexican-American border are directly related to the war on drugs, but they just turn their nose up at that and offer only platitudes and calls for even more government enforcement in those areas.
And speaking of Mexico, I saw an interview with Vicente Fox, the former president of Mexico, where he was saying that prohibition, he's calling for legalization. In fact, one of his really funny quotes was that he said, prohibition didn't even work in the Bible. Adam ate the apple. And so it's just, I mean, how bad is prohibition affecting countries other than the United States?
Oh, well, I mean, it's a tremendous disservice to countries around the world. And the U.S. is the primary promoter of the war on drugs around the globe. And if we look around the globe at the places where drugs are produced, and they more or less have to be produced there because of growing conditions, what we find is that all the countries that are involved in the production and distribution of these drugs are incredibly corrupt and very violent and very unnormal. And so you look at Mexico, you look at Colombia, you look at Bolivia to our south. You look at Afghanistan, for example, in Asia, or Lebanon, which was a big producer of drugs and a transportation link in the drug business. You look at Italy. All these places, corruption is just absolutely rampant, and it's all basically tied into making money off of the drug business that's related to those specific economies. So. It's very upsetting. It's very destabilizing, and it makes us look bad. It makes Americans look bad in the eyes of the average Mexican and the average Colombian, the average Bolivian. They don't like America because of our war on drugs and how it's undermining their society.
And what's worse is, I guess you'd call it salt in the wound, is that whether it was Air America exporting opium out of Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War, the U.S. government buying drugs during the Iran-Contra scandal, or the continued support of various drug lords in Afghanistan, parts of the U.S. government are supporting the drug war, are supporting the bad guys in the drug war, while at home it's fighting against the people here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're not stupid. They realize that, they're running the drug war, which is making the tremendous amount of profits in these drugs. And so if they ever need a little money here or there, they ever need to pass around a little influence here or there, sure, they can just engage in the drug business themselves, create tremendous profits, and as a result, achieve whatever goal they have in places like Nicaragua or Panama or Vietnam or Lebanon or Iran. You know, if you need to pick up some guns or whatever, it's there to be had. It's easy money, and they're running both sides of that game.
And why exactly is it that a war on drugs or prohibition, why does that lead to corruption?
Well, it basically, when you have a prohibition, you create two different profit signals. One is for the criminals to organize themselves into a monopoly, like the mafia, that controls a geographic monopoly. The monopoly does not want to have to deal with the police. And so instead of fighting them, basically they typically try to bribe them with money so that politicians, judges, law enforcement officials all get paid off so that the mafia can more or less operate in the open, where they can keep their monopoly relatively in the open, and then they give money to the people in the government, and they also turn in their competitors so that law enforcement gets money, and they also get ideas about who is competing with the monopoly, so that they can make a lot of easy drug busts, so that they look like they're really, you know, working on the war on drugs. So it's a win-win-win proposition whereby the criminals organize into a monopoly, and then they pay bribes in order to operate, and they turn in their fellow competitors. So it's just a sweetheart deal, basically, and that's why it's endemic big urban areas.
Earlier you started to talk about civil asset forfeiture, and I think this is one of the most prescient topics of corruption in the drug war. Recently here on Radio Free Market, Zoe Russell, another special commentator, conducted an interview with Aubrey Spaulding and John Payne on this topic. I recommend the audience check out this important interview on this massive government scheme. Civil asset forfeiture just really amounts to legalized theft, and it seems to be underreported as well. How does this compare to other forms of corruption in the drug war?
Well, it's, you know, it's out in the open, but it's, you know, it really, it's in the open and it stinks, basically. It's basically where the police find some evidence that you might be involved in the war on in drug business, and as a consequence, they use that evidence to confiscate your property, and they're basically often taking somebody's house who has no connections, no direct connections with the drug business at all. You know, their kid might get arrested for possession or something like that. And then very often what they do is they never even prosecute these people. They don't want the case to come to court, because in court the person might be found innocent and have to give their property back. So they arrest them, then they never actually bring the case to court in order to keep that property. So it really stinks for the people who just happen to get caught up in that whole process of having their property confiscated as a result of very flimsy evidence. I think it's probably one of the greatest injustices in all of government today, because you know, it wrecks families, especially in these trying economic times, and destroys their economic base for what very often are very poor people. They're not extremely wealthy people, but they get caught up in this whole business by coincidence.
The situation is just ludicrous. I mean, I've seen court cases where it's United States versus one Mercedes-Benz, or United States versus $325,000 currency. They're not actually going against people; they're going after the property.
Yeah, and if you try to cross a border with a large amount of cash, I've heard of instances where people where the money is confiscated on grounds that it might be involved in some way in the drug business without any collaborating evidence whatsoever. And then very often, you know, people are just sent on their way, and the court, the case never actually is prosecuted in any way. And so the people have no way of which to get their property back. It's just really disgusting.
Well, it's really clear from our discussion that the war on drugs really has become a war against Americans. It's always harmed Americans, whether it was the total prohibition of alcohol or the current war on drugs. I guess, you know, we should talk more about how to end this war. Specifically, I've heard of two proposed solutions, legalization and decriminalization. What exactly are the differences between these two tactics?
Well, legalization is just making everything associated with these products, these drugs, just the same as any other product. Whereas decriminalization technically keeps the drugs illegal, but greatly reduces the penalties associated with it and greatly reduces the amount of law enforcement's targeted towards these drugs. Both policies have tremendous benefits. For example, Holland has decriminalized marijuana, and Portugal has decriminalized all drugs. In both cases, what we've seen is the amount of drug use has declined. We've seen the amount of hard drug use amongst the drug-using population decline. We've seen the rate of addiction decline, and we've seen the rate of criminality in those countries also decline. So decriminalization is associated with general widespread social benefits really across the board. Nothing that we've seen in decriminalization has ever resulted in massive negative effects. But with legalization, we also get tremendous widespread social benefits. And it goes much more beyond that in terms of the overall benefits and also the benefits that the market economy puts into those industries. So what we see with legalization is safer products, less potent products, you know, just and a lot less addiction, obviously a tremendous drop in overdose deaths. We see the products becoming safer and safer over time. And so the preferred solution is certainly going to be legalization because it normalizes everything associated with these drugs, brings the control of the market economy to bear on these drugs and the drug users themselves. But decriminalization does have noticeable, tangible evidence in support of it as well.
Many individual states in the United States have enacted laws to allow some citizens the ability to consume marijuana for various medical ailments. How has the federal government responded to this?
Well, they don't like it, and they're generally against it. But even the National Cancer Institute was forced to put on their webpage that marijuana has benefits in terms of stopping and reversing cancer, some forms of cancer, I should say. And so, you know, we all think of and thought for a long time that marijuana was good in terms of reducing pain, in terms of stimulating appetite, eliminating nausea, you know, in some of the worst cases of cancer and AIDS and things of this nature, MS. But now what we're finding and the scientists are finding around the world is that marijuana actually has some positive medical properties. In terms of treating things like glaucoma, in terms of treating some kinds of cancer, nervous conditions, even some psychological conditions. And so we talked earlier about its industrial and commercial uses. We've talked about its recreational uses. But it turns out that marijuana has tremendous widespread medical applications as well. And, of course, you know, this stuff can be produced very, very cheaply. It can be very, you know, widely available. If produced commercially, it would probably have an even increased medical benefits that could be even more finely tuned and targeted. And this is one of the reasons why, of course, you know, we know why the beer companies don't like it, but the drug companies don't like it either because they see it as another low-cost alternative or competitor. And so legalization of marijuana and the spread of these medical marijuana laws is really a tremendous thing. And even in the state of Alabama, there was a poll done which found that more than 75% of the state of people of the state of Alabama support, and you know, we're kind of often viewed as sort of a backward conservative state, but 75% of the people of Alabama in this poll found were found to support the idea of medical marijuana, and so you know, the benefit, the cat's out of the bag with respect to that, that people know through direct evidence that they themselves have seen that their relatives and friends have benefited from the medical use of marijuana.
Well, we're going to be coming up quickly here on a break, but I did want to talk to, I mean, after the break, I want to talk more about, a little bit more about medical marijuana, but specifically delve into Proposition 19 in California. And, you know, it failed, but it, I guess, you know, it seems to be like, you know, there could be a interesting bootleggers and Baptist dynamic that went on there. So we'll cover that after the break.
Very good.
This is Radio Free Market. I'm Drew Yelm. Please stand by. After the break, we'll be talking more with Dr. Mark Thornton on the economics of prohibition and how to solve and fix this war on drugs. Please stand by. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm Drew Yelm, and I'm on the phone with Dr. Mark Thornton, and we're talking about the economics of prohibition. Now, before the break, we were talking about medical marijuana, and we started to get into Proposition 19, which was to legalize marijuana in California. Unfortunately, it failed. Why did that happen?
Well, everybody thought that it would probably pass, given that it was California, and it would have made a tremendous statement that the people rose up against a federal prohibition and against an international convention of prohibition, and basically said, no, we don't want to do it anymore. But as a consequence, every major politician in California, all the Washington politicians, the governor candidates, right on down, all came out strongly against it. They passed a decriminalization bill in order to stop it, which would find for possession only $100. And you had all sorts of group, beer distributors, evangelicals, coming out against this Proposition 19.
Well, there seems to be a silver lining, though, in that 46% of Californians voted for legalizing marijuana in California and ending prohibition. It could be said that the people are getting wiser to the true costs of drug prohibition. Given everything we've talked about today, what do you think are the next steps in this battle to restore liberty?
Well, I think that things actually do look good because they look so bad as far as the war on drugs is concerned, as far as the prisons are concerned, as far as the economy is concerned, as far as our health is concerned. People are waking up, and people are coming to their senses. I see the medical marijuana initiatives moving forward throughout the states. I see Proposition 19 coming up in California again and passing, and I see the movement for decriminalizing and, in fact, legalizing marijuana spreading. I see internationally, I see a lot of other countries, Portugal, Holland, Spain, the UK, Canada, that they're coming to their senses, they're reforming their laws, they're saying no to the United States. They're taking their own agenda. They're realizing the problems that the war on drugs has created, and they're trying to reduce the damage that it has on society. And the fact that all these drugs, if they were legalized, would create real jobs, would create real taxes, and would create real businesses, and would reduce crime, would reduce corruption, would reduce overdoses, I think is a compelling argument to make. And I think it's one that more and more people are listening to throughout the United States and around the world. People around the world look to the United States and say, you guys must be nuts to have this war on drugs, this war in Iraq, this war in Afghanistan, and wars, wars, wars. And the world is sick of it. And they're sick of Americans trying to press that message around the globe, and I think the probability of reversing that trend is upon us.
I definitely agree with that. I mean, it's really true what you just said. The long history of prohibition has been one of nothing but hardship and heartbreak for many Americans. I mean, many of them have lost tons of property, tons of freedom, and their lives even. So it's just one of those things that, you know, we need to change that in the future.
Yeah, when Roosevelt repealed prohibition, he took America from its lowest point in our history in terms of unemployment and crime and death and destruction and violence. And overnight, he brought society not out of the Great Depression, but he brought us out of the misery that existed with prohibition. And as a result, we had more jobs, we had more freedom, there was less violence and gun shooting in the cities. And his campaign theme song was Happy Days Are Here Again, which was all about destroying and repealing the evil, violent prohibition of alcohol throughout the 1920s, and happy days will be here again.
Well, I'm afraid that's the end of our show. I'd like to thank Dr. Mark Thornton for being with us today.
Hey, thank you, Drew. I had a real good time and we had a great discussion.
Yes, it was. This is Drew Yell and Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can subscribe for free to all of our shows on iTunes, or visit our Radio Free Market archives for easy downloads. Until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.